You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 30th of April 2024 on Monocle Radio. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Vincent McAvinney. Coming up on today's programme...
Tonight... I'm directing the U.S. military to lead an emergency mission to establish a temporary pier in the Mediterranean on the coast of Gaza that can receive large shipments carrying food, water, medicine, and temporary shelters.
2 months on from President Biden's State of the Union pledge, the U.S. unveils the first images of its aid pier for Gaza.
Every country is entitled to have its own migration policy, but I certainly don't intend to allow anybody else's migration policy affect the integrity of our own one.
Ireland's new Prime Minister promises action after Britain's Rwanda deportation policy prompts asylum seekers to flock over the border. Plus, the latest from Haiti on attempts to stabilise the country and a roundup of the latest fashion news. All that right here on The Briefing with me, Vincent McAvinney. As the world awaits news of a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas with talks ongoing in Egypt, the US military has released the first images of a dedicated aid pier they've been building alongside a naval vessel off the coast of Gaza. The project was announced 2 months ago by President Biden in his State of the Union address as a way of getting much-needed aid into the Strip. Well, I'm joined now by Middle East-based journalist Hannah McCarthy. Hannah, thank you for appearing on the show. What do we know about this pier the US military is building and how will it work?
Sure. So it's important before we start talking about the U.S. pier, just to kind of emphasize that this U.S. pier is ultimately a result of a failure of U.S. diplomacy in relation to Israel. We know repeatedly from aid agencies that the most effective and cheapest way to get aid into the Gaza Strip is by land. But because several of the land crossings are not open and have not been opened by Israel, the U.S. Decided to build this pier 2 months ago. It's a costly venture. It costs about $300 million, we know. It's still not functional. We've been seeing pictures now that have been released by the U.S. military. What's happening is this pier is being built in the middle of the Mediterranean, and then it will be basically pulled closer to the Gaza Strip. So the idea is that aid will then go to Cyprus. It will be loaded onto a large cargo boat, which will then be sailed across the Mediterranean. It will then unload at a docking station where the aid will be transferred onto smaller boats. These smaller boats will then be transferred into a pier closer to the Gazan coast, and then they will be transferred onto land. And then aid organizations will be able to take aid from an area near the pier. It is a complicated process, as I'm sure anyone listening to what I've just said has said. And after checks in Cyprus, aid going into the Gaza Strip will then be checked again. And we know that this has been this process of Israeli checks on aid have been described as time-consuming and arbitrary.
Just to break that down some, I mean, it's an incredibly complicated process logistically. Is the aid coming just directly from the US or are organizations being advised to direct aid through this process?
So the idea is that several countries will send their aid to Larnaca in Cyprus, where Israel will check it. They will have troops on the ground there, and then the aid will be put on a large boat there. Again, there are concerns because of how the military, this is a military led operation in that we know that US troops are involved in constructing this pier. There's also British troops and the IDF are also closely involved. US troops will not be on the ground in the Gaza Strip. This creates issues for UN agencies and humanitarian agencies who do not want to be seen as, you know, collaborating with Israeli authorities, because that creates issues for them in terms of how they fulfill their mandate in the Gaza Strip and creates tensions with the local population. The fact that it's going to be predominantly Israeli troops on the ground, you know, it creates a difficult situation for UN agencies who again say that UNRWA, the main UN agency that operates in the Gaza Strip, is being sidelined in terms of being allowed to actually deliver aid that's being delivered onto this US pier.
And in terms of if the aid does make it through this complicated process and actually get on land, on shore in Gaza, I mean, how will the distribution there work? Because obviously trucks have had problems getting in. There's a lot of problems on the roads, given the conflict. I mean, is there a plan in place for the distribution?
Vincent, what we understand is that there is still a lot of negotiation going on about how this aid will actually be distributed. One kind of issue is that the pier has not been located in the most northern part of the Gaza Strip, which is where we know is most in need, where people are on the brink of famine and have had the least aid. Instead, the pier is being located south of Gaza City, which means it has to go through Israeli checkpoints. So this means that the distribution of the aid is not a kind of simple, quick, direct pipeline into northern Gaza where people need it the most. So there's, again, a lot of debate and discussions going on about how this aid will actually be most effectively delivered. There's also concerns from aid agencies that while the US has said that the aid that's being delivered from the US pier will be supplemental to the aid that's already going into Gaza, which is already not enough, there are real concerns that once this pier is functioning, it could be used as an excuse to demonstrate that aid will go into the Gaza Strip in the event of an operation in Rafah. If there is an Israeli operation in Rafah, it'll be very hard to get aid in through the land crossings through Rafah and Kerem Shalom, which are the main crossings at the moment. So there's a real concern that rather than this US pier being supplemental or providing supplemental aid, it will be a replacement to aid going through the existing land crossings that is already not enough for the people in Gaza.
Mm. And in terms of the ceasefire talks, have there been any updates this morning?
Again, we're just hearing, we're all waiting for to get an update on that. Again, it's a similar kind of discussions that we've had since the last hostage deal. There are real concerns that Hamas, without a full secession to the hostilities, will not agree to a ceasefire deal. They are concerned that without the leverage they have from hostages, there will be very little to stop an Israeli assault that will crush their kind of remaining capabilities.
Hannah, thank you. That was Hannah McCarthy, a journalist based in the Middle East. Now here's Carlos Arabello with today's other news headlines.
Thanks, Vincent. A Russian missile attack on an educational institution in a popular seafront park in the Ukrainian Black Sea port of Odessa has killed at least 5 people and injured 32. Meanwhile, Russia says it's taken another village in the course of its offensive in eastern Ukraine. It's the second in 2 days. President Zelensky said Moscow was taking advantage of delays in the West, sending more weapons. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is in Amman, Jordan today as part of his 7th tour of the region since the October 7th attack by Hamas on Israel. The U.S. top diplomat will meet Jordan's King Abdullah II and foreign minister, as well as UN humanitarian aid coordinator for Gaza. And starting on May 5th, Chinese President Xi Jinping will visit France, Serbia and Hungary. It is the Chinese leader's first Europe trip in 5 years, where he'll look to boost ties with the EU as tensions mount with the world's second largest economy. Those are today's headlines. Back to you, Vincent.
Thanks, Carlotta. To Haiti now, where last Thursday a transition council took power in a ceremony following the resignation of former Prime Minister Ariel Henry. The council's mandate runs until February 2026, when elections are slated, and that cannot be renewed. Today, the council is set to vote on the next president as part of efforts to bring the Caribbean nation under control amid rampant gang violence. To discuss the latest developments, we're joined now by Dr. Christopher Sabatini, Senior Fellow for Latin America at Chatham House. Christopher, thank you for joining us. Firstly, who is on this transitional council and what is its remit?
The Transitional Council comprises representatives from different sectors of society, most of the major political parties, and that includes some complications, in fact, because some of them actually have loose ties to some of the gangs. business representatives, as well as religious leaders and civil society. So it's a broad council intended to really represent a diversity of views within Haitian civil society. But there have been complaints that, especially among the political leaders and some of the business leaders, it really is some of the usual suspects that have been around for a while in Haiti and calling the shots.
And does this council have much international support?
Yeah, it came about as a result of a negotiation with the CARICOM countries, the Caribbean Community countries in the United States, with the endorsement of France and others. And yes, it was really seen as the best way out of the crisis, which was precipitated, first of all, by the July 2021 assassination of then President Jovenel Moïse, and then the appointment of a recently sworn in President Ariel Henry, who happened to be in Kenya drumming up support for a multinational force to take control when the gangs took over. And so this was seen as a way to basically transition away from a president who really didn't have any authority, who was deeply unpopular, who had outstayed his term. He was supposed to step down in February this year and had not. So this was seen as a way of trying to force some transition to a group that would be more diverse and have more legitimacy.
And who are they likely to choose for president today?
It's going to be a tough question. I suspect they'll probably go to a civil society leader, because it's, again, what we've seen with the upsurge in gang violence is a broad rejection led by the gangs, but also with roots in popular opinion against the oligarchs, as they refer to them, as the elite. And that includes many of these officials. They're going to have to find a consensus figure. And then based on that, they'll have to choose a cabinet. This transitional council with a president and a cabinet will have to govern, as you mentioned, until February 2026. So it has to be diverse. It has to be representative. But most of all, it has to maintain some form of political and popular legitimacy. And for that reason, I think we'll see someone come out of civil society or a religious organization more than the traditional political class.
The council's installation is seen as a key step towards the deployment of a multinational security mission the UN approved more than 6 months ago. Is that likely to go ahead now, and how would it operate?
So it is going to go ahead. It's been put on pause. That was going to be led by about 3,000 Kenyan police forces. That is really on hold right now, because of the transition council and seeing what happens. The problem too, though, well, there's several problems, and I don't want to diminish when I say that the importance of this transitional council and their choosing of a president. This is really a very important step forward. But the Kenyan forces are on hold. The UN mission is severely underfunded. We're only looking at sort of a small percentage of the money. Only $18 million has been deposited in the UN Trust Fund to support this multilateral force. A number of countries have also pledged troops, Bahamas, Bangladesh, Barbados, Benin, Chad, Jamaica, but they're still on hold. But you're also going to require some probably more advanced troops on the ground to retake some of this territory from the gangs. Over 80% of Port-au-Prince, the capital, is controlled by gangs. It may not take a large force, but I think it's going to take U.S. Marines and U.S. boots on the ground to retake the country. And it's going to take basically countries ponying up the funding they have to make sure this works. There's also one other thing, by the way, is the base that the Kenyan forces were going to operate out of has not been built yet. It's going to be built by the U.S. That's not due to be done until May 23rd.
In terms of the U.S., I mean, the idea of putting boots on the ground in Haiti, particularly in election year, I mean, is that viable at all, given how strong the sentiment has been from Republicans in particular about, stopping foreign aid?
You're absolutely right. It is a difficult choice for the president to make in a very contentious political year. But the problem of not making it is it raises the risk of the other toxic issue, which is immigration becoming even more relevant in the election. We're looking at the possibility of massive outmigration by Haitians on both boarding boats and coming across the Caribbean as well as across the border with Mexico. And quite frankly, President Biden cannot face that. So, you know, one would hope that, you know, many of the Republican governors in the states that would probably most likely receive Haitian immigrants, that includes Florida and Louisiana, would be willing to step up and try to stem the flow of migrants to their shores.
In terms of daily life for ordinary Haitians at the moment, I mean, in the grip of the gangs, what is it like?
Since the beginning of this year, more than 2,500 people have been killed or injured as a result of the violence. You have 1.6 million Haitians that are on the brink of famine. That's because even humanitarian assistance is difficult to make arrive in Haiti. The airport is closed, the major ports are closed, and the gangs control most of the roads outside of Port-au-Prince. And you've got 50,000 people that are displaced. Many of them are living under sort of these pseudo states, illegal states of gangs that are controlling basically access to food, transportation, as well as imposing some sort of illicit justice on these communities. It is really a stateless society right now that needs to be retaken by a legitimate governmental force.
Dr. Christopher Sabatini, thank you. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. You're back with The Briefing on Monocle Radio. Now, after years of Brexit wranglings reawakening tensions between Britain and Ireland, a new spat has broken out over the effect of the UK's flagship Rwanda deportation policy. Ireland's new Taoiseach, or Prime Minister, Simon Harris, claims the fear of being sent to Rwanda is driving asylum seekers to cross the border from Northern Ireland into the Republic. This follows a decision by the Irish Supreme Court last month that the UK is no longer a safe third country to return asylum seekers to because of the Rwanda policy. Well, joining me now to discuss this is Belfast-based journalist Amanda Ferguson. Amanda, thank you for being on the show. Firstly, can you explain for listeners who might not be aware the special historical arrangements between the UK and Ireland which have allowed this situation to arise?
Yes, Vincent, at its heart, what we're dealing with here is a global migration story. It's a story about interdependence of immigration control and also about diplomacy. Now, because Britain and Ireland are island nations, there has been for over 100 years a special arrangement with regard to movement between the two islands. And also in that is because the island of Ireland is two jurisdictions. The Republic of Ireland is its own independent state, and then Northern Ireland is part of the United Kingdom. So it makes things a little bit complicated. Now, post-Brexit, there was a frostening of relationships between the Irish and the British governments, essentially over the arrangements that would apply to Northern Ireland, because I'm sure your listeners know that after the 1998 peace deal in Ireland, that there's an open border there, that people move freely across the island, and that Brexit meant tension and it had to be unique arrangements for Northern Ireland. So all of that is in the mix. Different issues around the British and Irish governments disagreeing on policy that relates to Northern Ireland, around the legacy of the past and so on. So it's been quite frosty relations in recent years. And then last week what happened was that the Justice Minister in the Republic of Ireland, a woman called Helen McEntee, essentially came out and said that about 80% of people who had recently applied for asylum there had come from Britain over the land border with Northern Ireland. Now, that figure has been questioned by some politicians and some human rights groups as perhaps not being essentially accurate. But if we forget about that for a minute, essentially what we found ourselves in is the position where the UK and Ireland have to come up with some sort of unique arrangement with regard to the impact that the UK's Rwanda policy is going to have. Mm. Now, Britain is planning to send people to Rwanda, And the Irish government is essentially saying that that is having a knock-on impact on the people that are arriving in the Republic of Ireland. So there has to be some sort of arrangement to deal with that. Now, the Taoiseach, the Prime Minister, Simon Harris, has said that he expects the UK government to honour an agreement that's been in place since 2020 to accept the return of asylum seekers who have travelled from Britain to Ireland. And this comes after the UK Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, had said that he wasn't interested in this. Now, the reason that that's a little bit controversial is probably because the UK Prime Minister is on an election footing at the moment, and migration has been one of the sort of top ticket items that he's promised to deliver on.
On that point, I mean, what Rishi Sunak has said is he's made it clear the UK won't take back asylum seekers when the EU, which of course, to be clear, the Republic of Ireland is the EU, Britain now not, the EU won't accept returns from France, where we've been seeing tens of thousands of people crossing in small boats each year. So there is a bit of a stalemate here, isn't there? There is a valid point being raised by the British Prime Minister.
Well, what Simon Harris is saying is that we have a legitimate expectation that agreements between two countries are honoured. And Mr. Harris was speaking today as the Irish government was having a head of a cabinet meeting where they were planning to introduce emergency legislation around this particular issue. I think that while everyone is focusing on what Rishi Sunak has said, the Northern Ireland Minister, Chris Heaton-Harris, the UK government's representative in Northern Ireland, has said that London is comfortable with Ireland's proposed legislation, having been briefed on the Irish Foreign Minister, the Deputy Prime Minister, Micheál Martin, on plans at the meeting in London that they had yesterday. So he said that, this issue that Rwanda has that Britain has for its flagship migration programme to Rwanda is causing migrants to head to Ireland. Now, that is being queried by some people. Rishi Sunak had said that the comments from the Irish government had showed that the Rwanda plan was working as a deterrent. However, some of the statistics are probably based on information and on feelings amongst people that work in that department in Ireland over the last couple of years. So it's quite complicated and it's not really clear. You know, there's no definite data that you can rely on. It's more what anecdotally people that are working in the Justice Department and so on are hearing. And I think people are looking for a bit of clarity and a bit of actual facts and figures and some firm information in that regard. It does complicate matters, the fact that the Irish and the British governments are co-guarantors of the Good Friday Agreement. So they're supposed to be there in almost like a parental role to ensure the peace in Northern Ireland. So this latest sort of diplomatic spat, which, you know, has the potential to be quite challenging if it isn't resolved, is an area of concern. However, the Northern Ireland Minister, Chris Heaton-Harris, his comments have been a bit less measured and less sort of focused on there being a diplomatic row. Both Chris Heaton-Harris and Micheál Martin were very clear yesterday in a meeting in London that they didn't want to characterise what had been happening as a diplomatic row. You know, obviously politicians would say that. However, it still remains that Ireland's Justice Minister, Helen McEntee, didn't turn up to the meeting in London yesterday after her counterpart, James Cleverly from the UK government, said he was postponing a meeting between the pair to discuss this particular issue, and nobody at the press conference yesterday in London wanted to ask the two governments about anything other than this Rwanda deal.
And in terms of, just to shift slightly to look at Ireland, obviously Rishi Sunak has an election this year, but there is an election next year in Ireland, and immigration is going to be an issue like never before, because there has been an outbreak of protests but also violence in Ireland over the past 2 years, because there have been unprecedented levels of immigration into the country. Ireland, of course, a country very used to people emigrating from it, and it's raised tensions, particularly with the housing crisis and crisis with public services as well.
Yes, that's right. You know, we know that the scenes that we've seen in Ireland with regard to protests about migrants and asylum seekers and refugee represents a minority of people. However, it is concerning, and it's definitely something that has become an electoral issue in the Republic of Ireland. It's happening now on both sides of the Irish Sea. The migration has become sort of a number one issue in regard to electoral campaigning. What we have in the Republic of Ireland coming up in June is the local elections and the European elections, and then a general election is due to take place before May of next year, and then of course in Britain the general election is due to take place probably at some time this autumn. So a lot of what's happening in regard to this row about Rwanda and about migrants and asylum seekers and so on is with that in mind. And I think sometimes whenever you're talking to the human rights groups, they're very keen to focus and remind people that at the centre of this are human beings, and they're not just returns as they're described, they're actual humans that are fleeing persecution or who may be applying for asylum after they've been in country for a while in Ireland for a variety of different reasons. So I think until we hear from the Irish government later today and we get a bit more clarity on where this 80% figure is actually coming from, this sort of speculation will continue. But the arrangement that there's been and that interdependence around immigration control has been a long feature of the two island nations between Ireland and Britain. It complicates matter that Northern Ireland is part of the UK and that the Republic of Ireland is part of the EU. And even that, there's caveats in that, in that the post-Brexit trading arrangements that apply to Northern Ireland don't apply in Britain, and we're seeing some of the outworking of that as well. So there's a lot of issues that are sort of causing a frosting of relationships between the two governments. But I think whenever it comes down to it, that some sort of compromise and pragmatic solution needs to be found. And also, this, as we said at the start of this story, it's a global story.
Amanda Ferguson, thank you. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. Now it's time for a check-in with the latest fashion news. Dana Thomas, journalist and author of Fashionopolis, The Price of Fast Fashion and the Future of Clothes, joins us now. Dana, what's caught your attention?
Well, the first thing is that last week, the big luxury companies all announced their first quarter earnings. And as some predicted, many of them have taken a hit. But no one was expecting Gucci caring to be so, have sales so profoundly low, or drop, and the, what made them drop was Gucci. That Gucci still hasn't gotten its turnaround yet, and that turnaround is key because, you know, they fired and they let go of their last designer Alessandro Michele like a year and a half ago, and they put in this lovely new young designer Sabato De Sarno. And he had his first show in September, which people thought was nice, but they haven't gotten the product in the store yet. So they've still been selling this old stuff by somebody they fired a year and a half ago, and nobody's interested in buying it. And the new stuff is just now landing in stores because it was for spring summer, and we still haven't seen how it's going to do. But Gucci's in trouble. Meanwhile, Hermes is booming. Hermes is still booming by selling things they've been making for 30, 40, 50, you know, even longer years. The Kelly bag was invented in the 50s. Kelly bags and Birkin bags are selling like crazy, and that company is booming. The downturn is because of China, which is slowing down on its consumption of luxury goods. They're kind of getting burned out and saturated finally. And it's not surprising. I mean, LVMH also saw a downturn. It's still making money, but it dropped down to only 2% in raise in revenue instead of, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, or 10%. And so the downturn in China will hurt LVMH, which is, you know, Louis Vuitton, Dior, and Givenchy and Celine, a lot more because 40% of their sales are to the Chinese. So if the Chinese decide they're off LVMH, you're going to see a big dip. And that will impact the wealth of the world's richest man.
And just one other thing outside of China. I mean, in terms of Western consumers, it feels like millennials and Gen Z, not only are they not that interested at the moment in kind of new fashion, there's a lot of buying vintage stuff, but they also simply just don't have the money, do they?
Well, actually, Gen Z apparently is richer than any of us have been at that age for, you know, decades, you know, my generation included. But they're just not interested in buying stuff. You know, these kids were all raised to be sharing things. They share their music, they share their cars, they share their apartments, they share everything. So they don't want to acquire and hold on to things. They want experiences instead, which is why LVMH, one of the reasons LVMH bought Belmond, the big hotel company that comes with the Orient Express train line, because people want to spend money on trips, vacations, luxury in that way, rather than stuff, you know, physical items.
And a week from now, the stars will be getting ready to attend the Met Gala in New York City, of course, for decades run by Anna Wintour, the executive editor at Condé Nast. But the Condé Nast union is threatening a strike ahead of the event.
It is. The union hasn't been around very long. It was a thing that came together during or post-COVID. Like, it's only a few years old. But they have a contract, and they're bargaining a new contract, and Condé Nast is not it's just not coming together. And Condé Nast is, I write for Condé Nast magazines, but they're having a hard time. They've been having a hard time, and one of the things they wanted to do is lay off a bunch of people. And the new union saying, no way. They were going to lay off 5% of the company, but 17% came from the union. Like, you know, they're getting rid of the union people, basically. And the union's really upset. So last week they marched on Anna Wintour's house in Greenwich Village, and they were chanting, "Condé Nasty, you can't hide, we see your greedy side." And we had posters that read, "Bosses wear Prada, workers get nada." This is what happens when your union's filled with writers, right? So they're getting some good headlines. They wanted to march on the CEO's house, Roger Lynch, but nobody knew where he lived. He's been very discreet about that, so they can't come and get him. But they're making a fuss about it, and rightly so, because the pay for writers and editors has gone down or been stagnant for years, and they keep laying off, you know, the people who only make $30,000 or $35,000 a year. And meanwhile, Anna Wintour, last I heard, was making $6 million a year, and that was before COVID.
I mean, this sounds like a dark, gritty sequel to The Devil Wears Prada in the making. Dana Thomas, thank you very much. And that's all for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Christy O'Grady. Our researcher was George Ruskin. And our studio manager was Steph Chungu. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time. I'm Vincent McAvinney. Goodbye, and thank you for listening.